Hello, my name is Crystal, and I was in prison for 11 years for the 2001 murder of Curtis Heath, which I was innocent and found not guilty. And I'm a fun-loving, outgoing person with a good heart.
Hi, this is Brooke, and I'm here with DeMarco, and you're listening to Actual Innocence. We're a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction and issues in the justice system. So how are you doing this week, DeMarco?
I'm doing pretty well. I had a very interesting week. It started off with, I don't know if I ever told you about the bone spur surgery I had. I had a bone spur surgery. I was dealing with pain for like 2 years.
Oh my gosh.
And the pain was unbearable. But you know, when you're in prison, you don't have any choice but to deal with it. So, you know, when I got out, I finally was able to reach out to a few doctors. Actually, I didn't reach out to a doctor. I told my story, and some doctors reached out to me, and they wanted to help me. So, you know, they did a surgery and, you know, try to alleviate the pain. And so one of the doctors just did, the surgery didn't work.
Oh, no.
So it was, I had a boot on for 3 weeks, and just 2 days ago, I had to get a injection. So my foot is actually feeling better. And I'm all right. But and the thing about the interesting week is, you know, due to the podcast, the previous one, the first one, my introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I had Mara. Mara, I think her name was M-A-R-A, Mara.
About the teeth?
About the teeth.
Yes.
She reached out to me, and she's assisting me with getting my teeth clean right now. And I want to thank Mara.
Yeah, I want to thank her too. She sent me a message on Facebook, and I said, you know what? Why don't you just email him and see if that would work? So yeah, I thought that was so thoughtful.
Uh-huh. So she reached out to me, and I was excited about that. And I always wanted to get my teeth clean. So, you know, next week I'll be able to get my teeth clean.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. And the thing about my week yesterday, I actually just got back. I was in Edmond, Oklahoma. I have a cousin, her and her husband stay in Edmond. So me and my brother, we drove to Edmond and hung out with her. And that was the first time that us three had been together since we were kids. And we was acting like little kids too. We was in there, we were in there giggling and, you know, just reminiscing and hanging out. And, you know, that was very enjoyable.
This week, we have an interview with Crystal Weimer. And unfortunately, DeMarco was not on that interview. Crystal is from Pennsylvania. And on her interview also was Liz from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. While I interviewed Crystal, we talked about like some women-specific issues that she encountered while at prison. And so I was wondering if it was okay if I asked you a couple of trivia questions about that.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So the first question is about feminine hygiene products. I recently read an article saying that there was a shortage of tampons and pads in women's prisons. And the possibility of that happening boggles my mind because it's like a medical necessity. So my question is, do you think Crystal is going to say that the women in her facility were provided with the appropriate supplies?
Oh, definitely not. She was not provided with the appropriate supplies.
She says that, you know, you either had to buy what you want or take what they gave you, but they frequently ran out. When you were in prison, was there ever necessary medical supplies that you needed that they were out of?
Oh, yes. All the time. You know, I recall a couple of times where there were no Band-Aids.
Oh my gosh.
You know, simple things as essential as Band-Aids, you know, if you get scrapes and, you know, cuts or whatever.
Because it's much more sanitary to bleed all over the place.
Yes.
I have one more question for you about women in prison. This one's multiple choice. In the year 1980, there were around 26,000 women incarcerated in the United States. So 34 years later, in 2014, how many women do you think were incarcerated? So there's four choices. Choice number one is 40,000. Choice number two is 120,000. Choice number three is 200,000. Or choice number four is 215,000.
I don't know what to say about that one there. I'm going to go with that last one.
You're right. In 1980, there were 26,000 women incarcerated. And In 2014, there were 215,000. That's a 700% increase. 700%. I was wondering if you had an opinion on why there's been such a huge increase in women in prison.
That's ludicrous. And I found that strange because when I was in San Diego earlier this year and it was so many women at the Innocence Conference, and I was, you know, taken aback, like, wow, I didn't expect it to be that many women. So, you know, I really don't have an answer to that one. So, but I was shocked that it was that many women at the Innocence. Yeah, it was. Whew.
This episode of Actual Innocence is brought to you by two sponsors, ZipRecruiter and Kopari. Remember, supporting our sponsors helps to support this show.
And supporting our show is very vital because, you know, we need to bring awareness to people that's not aware of situations like mine and other people's situations. But, you know, supporting our show is huge.
Finding the right talent for your business is important. Believe me, it took me a long time to find DeMarco. It wasn't an easy search. And now that I know about ZipRecruiter, I hope they can help you find the right person to fill your job needs. ZipRecruiter is great because it doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them.
80% of employers who post a job find a job in one day.
In one day? That's pretty amazing. But it's not surprising since ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 sites with just one click. You don't even have to juggle emails or phone calls. You can just screen and rate and manage the candidates online.
Yeah, the dashboard is easy to use. Even I can do it with no problem.
Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual. That's ZipRecruiter.com/actual. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual. DeMarco, do you remember what the code was?
ZipRecruiter.com/actual.
I have to give a major thank you to Crystal and Liz for taking the time to talk with me for this interview. To be honest, I interviewed Crystal twice because the first time, many months ago, my computer ate the interview. Crystal was 23 when she was accused of a crime that she didn't commit. But the story of her arrest and convictions are so twisted. This is Crystal's story.
Well, my parents were in love, and then they ended up getting a divorce whenever I was maybe 3 years old. They ended up separating and going their own ways, but they always had love for each other. And after that, like in my school days and stuff like that, I started getting involved with like cheerleading, softball activities as far as in school. It was real hard for my mom at one period of time, and she had problems, so we ended up going to like CYS for a short period of time. But after that, she got us back and everything was okay.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have three siblings. I have one older, and they're all girls, and two younger sisters.
I have one brother, and he was hard to share the bathroom with, so I can't imagine, you know, sharing the bathroom with three sisters.
Yeah, it was hard, but we all made it. And I think our relationship became even closer, like, all the years and stuff.
I'm going to fast forward you a little bit to January of 2001. And what was your life like in that period of time? I know that you were in your early 20s, right?
Right.
And so what were you doing? Were you working? Were you going to school? What was your life like?
Well, I work full-time at the Sony plant where they assemble TVs and radios and things like that. And I would work like three 12-hour shifts straight. And then I would get like three on, two off. But it like rotated. So I was busy with that while taking care of my daughters. I had three little girls, taking care of them and sending them off to school and making sure they were fed and stuff because I was a single mother. And that was it's my life, just caring for my children, working.
In January of 2001, and it seemed, I was looking at the date, it seems like it was like early morning on the 27th, so the night of the 26th. Do you remember what you were doing that day?
I was at my sister's. We were having a party because it her birthday and stuff. And we had like a gathering because my cousin, Doug, he was like in the Marines, in the Air Force. And he was home for a while. So we were just like gathering and drinking and, you know, social. But we were in Uniontown that night. And that's whenever my cousin had brought Curtis Hayes up there for a little bit because Curtis was his friend. And I didn't even know Curtis very well at that time. I knew of him, but through my cousin, but like on a personal basis, I really didn't even know the kid. But that's whenever everything started from that point on that evening.
So you were celebrating your cousin being home.
Well, it was that. It was like birthday and we were all like drinking and partying and we were together because not all the time we had the opportunity to come together and be together.
That night, a crime happened that you were accused of. Can you tell me about the crime? I mean, just what you know about it?
Well, all I know, my cousin wanted to go back to Connorsville where he, where Curtis Hayes lived, and he wanted to drop him off. Well, he was just going to go home because that's where my cousin lived after he dropped Curtis off. And I was like, no, well, why can't you come up and spend some time with us for the evening? Because, you know, we can finally see you and be around you. Well, at that point, he said, well, if you ride with me, you know, I'll be able to come back and I won't have to ride back by myself. If not, I'm going to go home. I said, well, you know, that's fine. So me and my daughter rode with him. And we dropped Curtis Hayes off at the Arch Cafe. It's like a restaurant-type bar. But we had dropped him off. We didn't even get out of the car. But we went back up Uniontown after that. And that was the last time I ever seen Curtis. But apparently, he went inside to the bar / you know, restaurant, where he met like 25 of his friends and associates or whatnot. So apparently they were all at the bar having a party. Well, I guess it was Stephanie Tabor's birthday and they went to Curtis's apartment. And when they left the bar, they took the party to his apartment. And that's where they all were. Meanwhile, me and Doug went back up Uniontown.
Curtis was murdered, correct?
It's that evening. Apparently, he was murdered at his apartment.
And so, do you know what made the police consider you a suspect?
I'm not sure.
No.
I have no idea. Like, from the point where they came to my apartment, like, the very next day, it was, like, early in the morning, maybe 9, 10. But anyways, I was just rested. I was in there in my mom's apartment because I had left my sisters and my mom, like they all lived in a row, like close to each other. I left Cynthia's and I had spent the night at my mother's. Well, the very next day when they came to question me, the officers said, well, I had spoke to your cousin, Doug, and he implicated that you had dropped Curtis off. So you're automatically going to be a suspect and you have to come with us for questioning. My cousin had told him that we had dropped him off. So we were never at the bar type restaurant or his apartment. We went back up Uniontown. We never seen Curtis after that.
Wow.
So as far as like their investigation and what transpired, like I don't on my paperwork, there was a few people questioned. But I'm not sure, like, as far as details or whatnot, I would have to, like, reflect back upon all that. But as far as I know, they already interviewed my cousin at this point. So when he said, you know, me and my cousin Crystal had dropped Curtis off, they came to question me and wanted information from me at that point. And, you know, I wasn't going to go, and then I didn't have no attorney or anybody to represent me at that point. I only went for the simple fact my cousin was there and she kept saying, Crystal, just go, allow them to question you and da, da, da. You know, I wasn't very adamant at all about even going.
And I read that you voluntarily had given the clothes that you had had the night before to them, like so they could test it.
Well, once I got to the police station, I was there for several hours. And I didn't have anything to hide. Like, there was no reason for me to hide anything whatsoever. So at that point, I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm already here. You know, I have nobody with me, you know, as far as an attorney or anything. So just let me give them my clothes and maybe they'll X me out. Therefore, I wouldn't be harassed or, you know what I mean? I wouldn't
right.
be questioned or anything. So I'm thinking, okay, well, if I give this, then maybe we can just have closure and I can go on.
And they tested it, right? They tested the clothes and...
Oh, yes. Everything was tested from my hair, my clothes, my blood. There was no DNA whatsoever as far as DNA of like Carter Case or anything out of the ordinary to even implicate me in this crime. It was actually the opposite, to, you know, allow me to go on with my life and closure I was hoping for that point.
I noticed that after they did that, it seemed like it kind of went away for a while, but then they came back. That was a lot of months later.
Okay, well, it was January 2001 when the crime happened.
Right.
From January 2001... So January 2004. So you figure 2002, 2003, 2004. 3 years later, I was arrested. And then my attorney at that point, he filed it's called a habeas corpus, lack of evidence. And they had dismissed and threw their charges out at that point because there was no evidence. And that was in April 2004. The attorney apparently never had filed a safety or like a prejudice type motion, which for the judge gave the option for them to refile charges if there was newly discovered evidence. So it was like maybe 5 months later in the month of September, I was rearrested again on a jailhouse snitch.
I read that back in 2004, that someone had written like a letter saying that you had been involved trying to get a lesser sentence or something like that. Is that true? Or
yeah, there was a lot of like faulty discrepancies and things in my situation, in my case, and it pretty much everything and anything possible in my situation had gone wrong. It went wrong, and it was in my case. So as far as like the jailhouse snitch, when they released me the very first time was whenever, you know, facts were provided at that point in the courtroom. And they had no choice but to release me. Therefore, they couldn't hold a person without, you know, a foundation or something that was even possible, you know. So.
And they were trying to, was it bite mark evidence? And then different experts said, no, that's not right. Am I right about that?
Yeah. You know, it was based upon scientific knowledge and, you know, as far as the expert that had came in, or one was for the Commonwealth. And then, you know, we had our expert as well. And well, their expert said that the cause of the man's death was the bite mark. It was planted upon him 5 minutes before, and it was the reason why the kid was dead was because of a bite mark, which, I mean, that just like totally blows my mind to even think that somebody would even say that, let alone believe it. So I was just in shock with the whole situation, because then towards the end, they state that it was never even a bite mark upon this big hit. It was a bruise and abrasion. So there were two different opinions, which the outcome of the bite mark, it never was a bite mark. It was a bruise upon the kid.
In the spring, the charges had been dismissed. And then again, and it was September, they rearrested you?
Yeah, in September, they rearrested me. I had to wait for a trial, like maybe a year and a half, 2 years later.
And so what were the charges? When you finally made it to the trial, what were the charges?
It was the same as the first time. It was criminal homicide in the third degree. Criminal homicide, third degree. But they also had me arrested for criminal conspiracy to commit third degree murder or homicide or whatever the argument was. I'm not very specific upon that, but they gave me 2.5 to 5 years for the criminal conspiracy charge. Then they gave me 12.5 to 25 years for the third degree criminal homicide.
Liz, can I ask you, what is third degree? Like, what does that mean?
Is one has malice or like intent with anger? Is that like first degree? Is that what that is, Liz?
Yeah. So first degree means that like it's premeditated. So, and premeditation can happen in an instant. So if, for example, you are in a bar fight, you have a gun on your belt, and at this point it's just fisticuffs, but then you decide to pull out your gun because you are just angry that this bar fight is going on, you can form premeditation in an instant. But yeah, it has an element of malice, and so you have to intend for that person to die. Whereas second degree is you never intended for someone to die. However, you engaged in a felony that is so serious or so dangerous that you should have known that it was a risk of your behavior that someone could pass away. And then third degree is anything that doesn't fit into those other two categories.
DeMarco, what was your favorite part of the summer?
Going to the zoo, seeing the gorillas.
I like riding my bike around the trails in the park near my house. Are you kind of sad that summer's almost over?
Yes, I am.
Well, Kopari, our sponsor, can help us stretch the feeling of summer just a little bit longer.
By doing what? How?
Well, Kopari's line of beauty products are made from 100% coconut oil. So not only do they do amazing things for your skin, they make you smell like you're somewhere tropical.
Wait, isn't that for girls?
I think Kopari is for anyone who has skin. Have you ever gotten a little bit too much sun and you felt like your skin was burning? Or do you ever just get dry skin and you can't seem to find the right moisturizer?
Yes, I do.
Then trust me, Kopari is for everyone. It soothes your sunburns and it hydrates your skin, all without harsh chemicals and leaving you smelling amazing. Say aloha to your best skin and hair of your life with Kopari. Go to KopariBeauty.com/actual to get 20% off your order. That's Kopari, KOPARI Beauty.com/actual for 20% off. Okay, DeMarco, one more time.
KopariBeauty.com/actual.
So, Crystal, I was looking at the I'm using quotes that you can't see with my fingers, air quotes, the evidence that they had, and it seemed like it was the bite mark that wasn't really a bite mark, and testimony from someone who was getting a deal for testifying against you, and then maybe some kind of soil evidence. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Well, the soil was, like when the expert come in, was from, like I said, my mom lived on a hill, my sister Carla and Cynthia, like they all lived beside each other. So it was like a little hillside. So as I was coming down the hill, I believe it was raining maybe that night before, and the ground was moist. So whenever I fell, it was a little bit of dirt on my pants, and it was a situation with soil that they wanted to test upon my clothes to see if it was placed, if it was the same soil that was at the crime scene. is what it was.
And how did your defense handle that? Like, how did they try to disprove that evidence in quotes?
I don't know. Liz, do you know?
What they said about the soil?
Yes.
So I know that the prosecution said that it was consistent with the soil that was found in proximity to the victim's home. I don't know, Crystal, how your defense counsel rebutted that, if at all.
Oh, okay. I know it was like a time after that there was an expert for us that said that the soil was from the climate, that it was totally different placed upon where we was to where the Curtis Hayes was.
So they called basically their own expert to say that, you know, that the other expert was wrong.
Right, right. So they like cross-examined them, like as far as the soil.
How long did your trial last?
It went on for, oh my, what was it, 5 days? It went all week.
And it was a jury trial?
Yeah, it was a jury trial. It took them, I believe it was over like 6 hours to even deliberate. So I know that there had to be like question marks upon each and every individual that was placed upon that jury. And for them to come back like and say guilty, I was just like in shock. I couldn't even imagine like that feeling, that thought. I mean, I thought I was going home. They come over to the jail while I was waiting trial, and they offered me 2 to 4 years. I mean, several times. The DA would come over, or like the investigator, like as far as, you know, the public defender that would come over and question people, and, you know, with pleas or offers for people that were, you know, through the public defender. But they didn't just come to see me one time. They were coming very often to offer me that 2 to 4 years. Like, they were real persistent about me accepting a 2 to 4 year plea, knowing in my heart and my mind that I was already innocent. So there was no way I was taking a 2 to 4 plea for something I had nothing to do with. Like, I was very determined I was going home. I think there's a reason why they're offering people like these plea deals. And I believe in my heart that a lot of people get fearful and they're scared, like as far as the system and not knowing, like that question mark, like knowing in your heart that you are innocent, but the fear of like, oh God, what if I can go to prison and maybe not have a 15 to 30 sentence, maybe have a life sentence or a death sentence or, you know, something to that nature. And they're very timid and they take the plea deal because they don't want to, you know, have that risk of saying, oh God, okay, what if I'm not going to go home, you know, and maybe I better hurry up and take something because it's easier for them to offer a plea and somebody to say, okay, well, we accept, in order for somebody to say, okay, wait a minute, I'm going to take a stand for what I believe in. I know I didn't do this, and they're not going to convince me I did something I didn't do. So in your heart, you feel like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go home. I'm confident, and I know who I am, and I know this is going to be over, so it's almost over. So you think and feel in your heart, okay, well, it's going to be over soon. So when they come back with a guilty verdict, you're just like, what? Where did this come from? Are you serious? Like, you didn't see the questions, you didn't see the doubts, you didn't see all these different stories that were lies after lies after lies. You know, you couldn't see through this whole thing. Surely there has a question mark, if not one, many of them. So if you had that doubt in your heart and your mind, how can you come back knowing that you're being trusted with this individual's life and say guilty? I mean, that's scary.
It must be very hard to be a juror. I can't imagine, you know, what I've never been on jury duty, but what goes on in that room that convinces people, you know?
Right, right. Because each individual part surely is being discussed and talked about. any kind of questions, any kind of doubts, it should be discussed upon the peers that are in that room, right? So if you have question marks about certain things and situations, how can you just say, okay, well, forget them questions and listen to maybe five other ones in there, or say the majority, maybe nine other ones or 10, and say, oh, okay, well, I give up. Okay, guilty. Why not take a stand and just continue to stick out what you believe in your heart? Yeah, that must be I can't even imagine having somebody's life in my hand. And if I have doubts, who am I, or how could I even live with myself to say, okay, well, this person's guilty? Now, if there's evidence and it's factual, and you're saying, oh, okay, well, automatic, this person I believe in my heart is guilty, there's no question about it, then that's a different story. But I think a lot of times, too, on jury duty, and there are citizens living in society, in the world, out working and living normal lives, and they're picked for jury duty, a lot of times, too, I feel in my heart that they don't want to go against the district attorney nor the police. So automatic, when somebody's on trial, they're guilty.
Yeah, it's my impression that a lot of people, you know, the police are the good guys. And so when they testify or when they say things, that they get more credibility than other people, just because we're taught from a very young age that the police are there to help us.
Right, right. And that's not always the case.
Right. That's why I have this podcast. The jury says guilty. And then what happens next? I mean, can I ask, where did your children go?
My two oldest daughters were with their grandmother. And she took sick, and she ended up in a nursing home at that point. While they were, my sister was taking care of them there for a short period of time. Well, she ended up not being able to care for them. So they ended up in DYS. My two oldest daughters. But thank God that my baby, her grandparents raised her and took care of her the whole time. You know, I was very grateful and thankful that she had them. You know, she was fortunate and didn't end up in the system. But it was very hard, and the girls had both struggled, my two oldest daughters, by not only being in the system and being away from me, and then experiencing all the stuff that they were going through throughout their life, you know, for 11, 12 years without their mother. So, I mean, it was just really difficult for them.
What was prison like? What was it like to be in prison?
Oh, it was very hard. I mean, you figure all different kinds of people, you're just pretty much just tossed in this community, which you're totally closed out of anything from the outside world. And, you know, there was several of them that wasn't very pleasant and nice. And, you know, you have different types of people, people that are very manipulative, and, you know, ones that take advantage, and then you have ones that, you know, are good, loving people. And some that went to church and had their faith and things like that. And that's pretty much I just stuck by God and went to church and would try to walk and maintain my sanity through it all. You know, I was always trying to educate myself through the law library and, you know, do my homework and try to be productive in a positive manner. But it's just hard because you have to differ, you know, the different people, and you get to know them because you're around them often. So the troubled people, you try to keep your space and your distance and stuff.
I just read this article about how there is chronically a shortage of pads and tampons in prison for women. Did that ever happen? Was that ever an issue? Did you have the supplies that you needed?
There was several times that we ran out of toilet paper, and then they would have to call different housing units to see if they had any extra or backup supplies. And as far as personal products, you had to buy your own. If you wanted Tampax or something like that, you would have to buy your own. but no, she wanted like just a sanitary napkins, like the pads and things like that. They would even run out of them at times. They would have to call different housing units to see, you know, if they have backup supplies. So it was always an issue because like their population has grown tremendously from 580 women whenever I first arrived there in prison until I left, the population was like over 1200 and some women. So it increased like even more than half. But as far as like their budget deficiency, like it's real bad. It's just like getting worse. Like even like the food supply, like we had a third shift, you know, where they used to make like homemade bread, biscuits, buns,
oh, wow,
stuff to that. I mean, real good food. And the portions were extremely well. You always were full. Before I had left, the third shift stopped. There's no longer no homemade breads, biscuits, buns, rolls, none of that. And the portions were just real, a lot smaller. Like maybe half of what we used to get is about half of the portion. That's how small they are now.
And were you in the same facility the whole time?
No, I moved. I was like in the progressive unit, like further down the line. But I tried it there a couple times. And there's like a lot of long timers there, like lifers. And, you know, they just get set in their ways. And it's a real hard unit to live in. Because I'm more of a type of person that I like to come and go. Like, I don't like people tell me what to do. And how do I want to say it? Like, independent. Like, I'm a very independent individual. And maybe headstrong. And yeah. So I kind of like fell back from that and just went to a different unit. But, you know, I tried it a couple times on the honor unit and it just wasn't for me. But the regular units are pretty much laid back. You do your own thing. Like you don't have people dictate or tell you this or, you know, it's bad enough that you have to you stand for a head count, you know, 3-4 times every day, you know, go to meal. Everything's just order already in there. And what little bit of freedom that you did get, you wanted it for yourself. You didn't want somebody to tell you what to do. You know what I mean? If you can understand.
Yeah, to have no control, what control you have, you wanted to be in charge of that.
Yeah. Pretty much. That's where, yeah.
So I have written down that the person who testified against you like recanted their testimony. Is that what led to you starting your journey to being free?
It's like once October 2nd, 2015 came, things just pretty much took off. But I know like whenever I filed my federal, maybe that you're talking about my federal habeas corpus. When I submitted and filed that, like they granted me representation immediately. So I had a lawyer, a federal attorney from the public defender's office. They were submitted to brief everything. You know, they were granted to everything that I submitted and filed, they had to brief it. So right after that occurred, you know, the Innocent Project was beside me. Like they had my story the whole time.
That's what I was going to say. How did you get connected with them?
Yeah, like they had my story the whole time. And, you know, there's a process that they have to go through and stuff as far as their interviews and different things that have to meet their criteria in order for them to take upon a case because they do like a thorough investigation. So once the federal opened my case immediately and gave me an attorney, that's whenever the Innocent Project said, hey, wait a minute. You know, we have to represent this girl, you know, because the federal obviously sees merit upon her case. That's whenever they said, okay, well, we're going to represent her as well.
Did it feel good to have a team behind you?
Yes. Oh, my God. I feel so blessed. I'm so grateful and thankful. Like all the love and the support, you know, it's just, it's amazing. I'm just so thankful and grateful. You know, that's whenever the Jones Day and, you know, everybody come together, and it was just like, it happened so fast. Like, you know, nobody thought, like, as of that day, when I went to court October 1st, we, like, everybody was in awe because it happened so quick. You know, we had to get a judge out of the county. Yeah, because so much, like, conflicts and stuff within that county, so we had to get a new judge. And once the new judge came in, that's whenever everything was just opening, like, boom, boom, boom. Like, it just happened so fast. So as of October 1st, 2015, that's whenever they were like, okay, this woman has to be released. This is it.
And Liz, did you tell me that was your first day? Was your first day when Crystal was released?
So my first day was June 27th of 2016. And that was the day that we were scheduled to appear. Crystal was scheduled to appear for a motion to dismiss for pretrial motion because she still had, you know, the retrial hanging over her. And on that day, the charges were dismissed with prejudice. And Crystal's ankle bracelet was cut off by probation, and she was officially free and no longer had charges hanging over her head. Her official exoneration day was my very first day at work.
Aww.
You know, I had moved back from the Virgin Islands to the Pittsburgh area for the job, and it just solidified everything that I believed. I was thinking, yes, I am in the right place. This is amazing. I mean, you don't get to witness something so extraordinary very often.
So you're free, like you're free to go, you're exonerated. But what happens next? What resources did you have? Where did you go?
Well, after like I was released on that day, like the whole team of attorneys, everybody all got together and went to the store, and they purchased like a lot of like personal clothes and items and snacks and shoes and things, you know, after being away for so long and, you know, having a house within a period. I had like two or three houses just within that 1 year. So like all my stuff is totally gone, but they all come together and work together to make sure that, you know, I had a couple clothes, outfits, and provided me food and just personal things that I needed. And it was just so amazing. And then, you know, took me to a hotel where I got the first thing you want to do, you definitely want to shower. After coming out of a dirty prison, a place like that, like you want to get clean, fresh, like that scent, that feeling. So I just got a nice warm shower. We all went out. They took me out to dinner. We went to Red Lobster, and we just, everybody had a beautiful time. And I was just so over, I couldn't eat. I just kept crying. It was just so overwhelming, just like grateful and thankful and just, you know, tears, like expression of just like gratitude and grateful and thankfulness. It's just like, wow. But it was just so nice to have that feeling and stuff as far as like support through like my family and stuff. You know, I went to my mom's and she was there for me, you know, as far as having my ankle bracelet and stuff. So I went and I stayed with her, which was nice. And there's not a whole lot of other resources that, I mean, there should be more things available, but, you know, I survived, and I'm just so grateful and thankful that, you know, it all worked out the way it did. And, you know, having that attorneys and team, and it was just beautiful at that point.
Can I ask, did anybody ever apologize? Not your team, but like the team that prosecuted you, did anyone ever apologize or?
Oh, no, I've never heard like, oh, we're sorry, or, oh, we made a mistake, or nothing like that. Not only like I feel bad for like Curtis Hayes and his family and stuff like that, but as far as like me and my family, like we were victims also. And there was never no closure or nothing as far as like all that stuff.
So I hear a very like grateful, thankful person that I'm talking to. How do you think that this whole experience has made you look at the world? Like, do you think that you're more thankful for the things that you have now? Do you think you're less trusting?
Oh, yeah. Right. Because, see, when you're experiencing something like that and you're in places and you see all the things and the different people, and it's just like, you know, sometimes like a person that's maybe sick or on deathbed or something in the hospital, and they have like a near death experience. It's similar to like that. And sometimes I think if certain people would just have like a wake up call somehow, some way like that, they would be more thankful and more grateful. You know, not that I would wish or want bad or harm upon anybody, but I think a lot of times, you know, if people experience that, they are like more grateful, more thankful, you know, because of the hard times and the struggles and the, I don't even want to say, maybe like not having money, working, making 18 cents an hour.
You're right. Like people like me who we take for granted, you know, our happiness because we've never had something like our freedom taken away. And so I can imagine that you have much more appreciation for being free than I do because I've never not been free.
Like I said, like even making like 19 cents an hour and doing like really hard labor, like, you know, the all the women in that place take care of that place. Like the guards and the correctional officers, all they do is like pretty much just babysit everybody and make sure everybody's safe. But as far as like the maintenance and stuff, the women do everything. So you could imagine.
So I have two more questions for you, okay?
Okay.
So the first one is, what advice might you have for someone who finds themselves in your situation, like they're being wrongly accused or they've been wrongly convicted of a crime? What advice would you give them?
My advice to them would be, don't ever give up. Be who you are and keep fighting, because it's going to be a battle. There's going to be, you know, crossroads. There's going to be hills. There's going to be valleys. But you have to be persistent and be determined to get the victory and overcome all the stuff coming against you. Because if you don't stand, you'll fall for anything, you know? So I would just encourage them to keep believing that there's always hope and, you know, there's always a good side to something. That's what I would say to them. Don't ever give up. Because there's a lot of people, they just get tired of fighting and they're just like, okay, that's it. I'm done. But you have to keep going.
I think that's a great answer. There's like a million people who listen to this show. And I get emails every week, lots and lots of emails of people asking me, what can they do to help? People who haven't been wrongly convicted, but they want to help people not get wrongly convicted. What do you think ordinary people like me can do to help?
I think a lot of times, like I was saying, like as far as the jury duty, to have more understanding. Like if you are called to a jury duty, just be open. Be open and don't think it's just one way. You know, like it's like everybody always says, you know, the cops are good. Just be open-minded to that and be educated that there's always two sides to every story. And also, I think that I feel in my heart that it should be illegal to even question anybody without an attorney present.
Right. It shouldn't be an option.
Yes. Or it should be video, like a video, a camera to know what's going on with that person, to see what's going on behind the scene, as far as like an interrogation, they call it. If there's a video camera or something, at least people can see what really transpired at that moment.
I agree. You can't be like your words can't be twisted.
Right. And I think that's very crucial and very important in so many cases. But it's always overlooked, you know, because they don't have video cameras. And maybe it would stop a lot of like injustice or, you know, people just being wrongfully convicted or anything.
Okay. Liz, can I ask you one last question?
Sure. Absolutely.
What do you think that us non-attorneys can do to help people who not be wrongfully convicted or help change the justice system so that less people are wrongly convicted?
Well, I totally agree with Crystal. I mean, I think just knowledge and education about how the criminal justice system works is, I think that, you know, going out and just raising your voice, letting your local legislators, your state legislators know that the budget that the local public defenders get from the state and the county is inadequate, and that we need, you know, we need better funding, we need better indigent defense. Many, many, many of our wrongful convictions stem from inadequate public defense.
And it's not even just the fault of the public defender. It's, you know,
no.
The caseload and the funding. And yeah, absolutely. I know what you mean.
Absolutely. And let me say, I was a public defender. You know, I like to think that public defenders are in the nitty gritty every day, or they are some of the best trial attorneys that are out there because they do it every day. But they also are overwhelmed and overburdened, and there's just not enough hours a day to get through the seriousness and the amount of cases that they're assigned. So we need more people to take up indigent defense. We need better funding, and also we need better training. You know, you can't have a law student come directly out of law school and have someone's freedom in their hands without training. So we really need to educate our young lawyers about how the criminal justice system works, what are the loopholes, what are the things that we need to preserve for appeal, and make sure that, you know, the full weight of the government is not coming down on our defendants without the protection of experienced and knowledgeable defense attorneys.
Until next time, thank you so much for listening. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. Rough editing is done by Brooke, and master production is done by John Kerr. And our original music was made by Blake Maples. Thanks for listening.